Hello, this is Mike Harbaz with this week's Shoot the Moon podcast, broadcasting live and direct from Arizona today. I'm here with my partner, Ryan Barnett.
Good morning, Mike.
Hey, good morning. Today we are going to talk about It Is a Seller's Market, a white-hot seller's market. And we're going to talk about some of the things that are driving the seller's market and what to expect if you're a seller, and more importantly, what to expect if you're a buyer. Ryan, what are you seeing out there?
Well, you know, when we look at our business, we as a company do M&A advisory for IT services companies. You know, in our traditional mix, we have about 60-70% of our is going to be on the buy side. So we represent a lot of buyers that are out there trying to grow their company, either organically or inorganically. We help them on the inorganic side quite a bit to help buy other companies to accelerate their growth. And about 30% is sellers. At the moment, we've had just a large influx of buyers who are really interested in buying. And we think that's due to there's a bit of flush of capital in the market. There's a lot of dry powder that's sitting in funds and private funds and family funds and investments. And there's dry powder out there to put to work. And this is a market that really deserves good sellers. There are a lot of companies that have really nice recurring revenue models that make a very nice investment. But what that means for everyone in the marketplace is that it's becoming a bit harder to get a deal done if you're trying to buy a company. And the thing that we keep coming back for that it's more than the money. And let's just start out, Mike. I got a question for you in general is, you know, why is this a seller's market? What is making today so hot for sellers, and what should buyers know about that macroeconomic switch?
Yeah, it's a great question. You know, we get this question kind of a lot, and we've seen, you know, a huge transformation. I mean, certainly it's been building to a seller's market for a while. And what I mean by that is it's been probably the last several years, we've been seeing valuations going up. We've been seeing, indications in particular niches within IT services that it's a seller's market. We think that got dramatically accelerated due to COVID, actually, partially because demand for digital transformation work and remote work support went up dramatically during COVID, which buoyed a lot of these firms, and certainly stimulus didn't hurt. It helped companies make investments through this increasing demand sort of period. But it also moved and transitioned a lot of traditional investment sources around private equity or family office or you know, other capital sources towards IT services because of the dramatic increase in demand. Obviously, traditional investments in, you know, real estate or, you know, what we would consider typical kind of investment strategies, corporate real estate and you know, hospitality and things like that went down because of just a lack of demand. So there's a lot of capital flowing into the space. And I would say also, you know, there's been a number of, you know, pretty high profile exits with relatively high valuations. And many of the people that benefited from those exits that owned equity or phantom equity and participated in those exits have pooled their money to create funds that are now reinvesting in tech. And so, you know, it's kind of a what we'll kind of call a second generation inflow of capital based on folks that took exits over the last several years and participated. And they want to get, you know, another early stage investment opportunity. So lots of variables as to what's, you know, driving this, but certainly there's a tremendous amount of cash on the sidelines, that people are willing to invest and quite a bit of demand, in, you know, particularly recurring services or what are perceived as relatively safe investments for return on capital.
Absolutely. There's just a lot of powder to go around. Mike, I think you had mentioned this to me somewhere along the line, but it sounded like you had a phrase from a movie, a very famous movie. And I was wondering, it's not coming to the tip of my tongue, but It's something I think from Jerry Maguire. What was the phrase?
Yeah, absolutely. This is my favorite movie quote of all time, and it's "Show me the money, Jerry Maguire. Show me the money." Right? Critically important, but not the only thing that's important in getting a deal done. I think there's a lot of people who are trying to assemble their financing as well to do a deal. We see a lot of early stage funds that are saying, "Hey, we want to get to a transaction so we can go fundraise around that transaction." That thesis, you know, certainly can work, but it's challenging because, you know, with ever increasing valuations on the sell side, it's more than money, right? It's really more than money. And when it's money that you have to really look at, you know, what is the strategic imperative for the deal? And the strategic imperative around the deal will drive the 1 + 1 = 3. And, you know, we think that sellers in particular should be looking for that and are looking for that. So if you're a buyer, you need to have your game on, right? It's not just the cash that's going to get this transaction done. It's going to be the, you know, strategic and cultural aspects of the deal. And I would emphasize strategic around the 1 + 1 = 3, where you can get somewhere together that you can't get apart. And so, you know, as much as, you know, cash is king and, you know, what's perceived as a fair or high multiple is desired as a seller, even if you're prepared to offer that as a buyer, it's more than that. It's much more than that. And you can't just come to the party with, you know, a bag full of cash and say, "Hey, we want to buy your business." You know, I think sellers know that the market is consolidating. They know it's a seller's market. And they're asking the hard questions, which are, how is my company better off, even if I'm going to exit based on this transaction versus not? And you need to be prepared and have your game on to talk about that.
So what I'm hearing is that it's much more than about money, and that there's got to be value and alignment and even a bit of working together. So if we break that down, what should sellers be looking for with a buyer when it comes to the strategic fit of the business?
When we look at strategic fit, we look at, you know, I think it has to really become, you know, that this cornerstone I mentioned earlier about, you know, can you get somewhere together that you can't get apart? I know it sounds like a simple premise, but it really has to be vetted. And, you know, I think the best deals and the best value creation come in those scenarios. And I'll use an example, one I think that is kind of fascinating. We had a client that we represented on the buy side a number of years ago that paid twice the market rate for an acquisition. And they were certainly, you know, in a situation where they were in a position to do it because they're a much larger company than they were acquiring. They were sitting on a lot of cash. And because of that, they ended up, you know, being able to do the deal. But there was members of their management team that thought it was crazy, right, that they didn't or couldn't, you know, that they shouldn't do that, that they shouldn't pay up like that. But the reality of it was that they were going to be able to get a return on that investment, even at that much higher price point, within 2 years. And thus the business case existed for them to execute on the deal. And what the cornerstone of that return rate, you know, acquisition scenario was that, that they were able to, they were able to, wouldn't have been able to get to a deal, without paying up, if you will. And they were still able to get to their return rate because of the, you know, 1 + 1 = 3. They were able to get to a place together that they couldn't get apart. And it's turned out to be a super successful acquisition. You know, we're probably out 3 years or maybe even 4 years. It will be a situation where, they will be able to successfully, you know, get a huge return on that over time.
Yeah, it's a great story, and it also helps highlight that that story has to be told as a buyer to the seller today. So it can't be a story in a vacuum. It has to be, this is our strategy. This is where we're going. It's our North Star. And you as an acquisition candidate are going to be a big part of it. And again, it's not just about the money of where we're going. It's really about how can we execute a vision together where you're either filling a technology gap, a resource gap, or even a functional process gap in the past. So it's something where the buyer really has to do a good job just projecting where they're going. And even if it's a financial buyer, it has to have a strategic imperative. It's much more than we're consolidating and looking for future markets.
Yep, absolutely agree with that. I think in thinking about, this combination of, and we've talked about this a lot, right? Is it strategic, cultural, and financial fit? They really need to happen in that order, and I think a lot of financial buyers get that order screwed up. They come to a deal thinking that it's all about the financial fit. It's not really. It's much more about, do we have a great strategic imperative to get someplace together that we can't get apart? Number one. Number two, what's the cultural aspects of this deal, right? Can we work together? Do we think that the culture is healthy in the business that we want to, acquire or merge with? Can we really, get some additional skills and talent in the business that we don't have today? And then lastly, the financial components of the deal, the financial fit. Oftentimes we vet and qualify the financial fit up front, but the challenge with that becomes that it's not just, as we've said before, not just about the money. It just is so much more than that. And we think that if you're a material buyer and you're particularly a financial buyer, one that comes from outside the industry, maybe, or maybe thinking of it as a financial, more of a financial transaction, you got to get your game on the strategic imperative and the cultural imperative to do the deal. Otherwise, you're not going to transact deals at any price.
Yeah, and I think buyers and sellers, they need to figure out that cultural fit. And it comes down to some of the very first aspects of meeting. When there's an introduction meeting, when a buyer meets a seller for the first time, that they come interested and prepared. I think oftentimes if a financial buyer comes to the table, they may have all sorts of questions about the financials, when in reality, the buyer is just trying to understand, are you going to, buy and gut my company? Are you going to buy and grow my company? There's a level of comfort that a buyer has to get that lets their legacy continue in some kind of way that helps their employees and investors and stakeholders grow beyond the sale. And so the culture, I think, starts right away, and it's a big thing that you have to master quite a bit. And it's not exactly easy, but it's something that we continue to advocate throughout the entire process, that to get to know each other and to get a sense of comfort of where things are going. And to be fair, understanding the seller will have changes. Not every person may survive an acquisition if there's completely redundant roles. Think of perhaps of a bookkeeper that overlaps. So that being said, one can look for cultural fits and clues along the way in the process. Now, Mike, if we think about where, assuming the strategic and cultural fit fits up, and it does become about the money. We often say, if you have the first two, strategy and culture align, the money typically works out. When it turns into a seller's market, how does that have to change? Is there additional scrutiny on the financials, the company? What changes?
Well, I think the problem is that a lot of people expect that they can just do these deals kind of willy-nilly. And what I mean by that is sellers go, I should be worth – they just get delusional about their value. And I think because they get delusional about the value, they think that any company, they should be able to sell that business for any price, so to speak, even if they don't have good financial rigor. And so, you know, I think from a seller's perspective, you got to make sure you have your game on no matter what, if you're thinking about selling. And if you're, you know, if you're a buyer, you certainly need to be doing the same level of diligence you would do, you know, which is prudent, against any buyer, because I think a couple of things come to mind. One thing is that, you know, bad actors come out, right? In a high demand market, bad actors come out, and you're going to have guys that are trying to sell businesses that either don't exist or fraudulently putting forth numbers. And as a buyer, you need to be aware of that. You need to be prepared to, you know, root that out by doing quality of earnings analysis and being very diligent and hiring professionals to, you know, evaluate the diligence and make sure that you know what you're buying. At the same time, if you're a seller, you got to make sure you have your act together and that you don't have big anomalies in your financials, because that's just going to, you know, create a big problem and frankly going to blow up any deal once it gets to that point.
Sure. And if you look a bit at where things are going with buying, there's so much competition in the marketplace. What do buyers need to do on a financial way to set themselves apart? Is it finance, you know, it's the financial commitments that they prove, here are the investors that I have and their portfolios, or here's the fund that I'm backed by, or here's the money I'm able to raise, or here's the bank I'm working with. What are ways that, you know, financially a buyer can essentially prove their mettle?
Yeah, I think that they have to have their financial house in order to be able to show it, right? And you have to be able to show how you're going to be able to fund the transaction. We've had more and more sellers asking for proof of funds earlier and earlier in the process. And so if you're looking at a deal and you're going to go do it, it can't be just take my word for it, I'll go raise the money post LOI anymore, right? You've got to be in a position to show them the money. And I think, you know, back to the Jerry Maguire quote, right? It's got to be put together. Now, you know, if you're doing leverage buyouts, as an example, you know, most banks aren't going to show you the money or even give you necessarily a commitment letter, although many banks are starting to do that before a letter of intent. And so it makes it a little bit tricky, right? I mean, you have to be able to, you know, secure a letter of intent or at least deal terms, call it a term sheet or IOI or whatever it might be, in order to secure debt financing if you're a buyer. And it's, you know, most banks won't talk to you unless you have a signed letter of intent, just as a heads up. So that it's a little bit of a chicken and an egg dance that you're going to play. I think if you're a financial buyer, you should have access to the capital before you begin that conversation. And I think it's challenging to not. Now, there's plenty of funds that are spinning up and that will be successful in doing that because they're looking at saying, hey, we want to see some example transactions. So if you're, you know, someone who's going to put money into a fund, you want to know that you're going to be able to put that money to work. Because likely you're going to put a time bomb on that, meaning you're going to say, look, we're clawing this money back at a premium for the carrying cost if you don't put this money to work within a year or 2 years or whatever. That's typically how, you know, private equity works, right? We're going to commit money and we're going to commit it based on these requirements. And, you know, you either put it to work or we're going to take it back. And those commits, there's ways to see that those commits are in place prior to, you know, a transaction funding from, in the case of private equity. It's not the only way that private equity works. I mean, they certainly, you know, raise funds and, you know, have the bank put together, but you should know that there may be there's different proof points that have to be made or shown, if you will. I think the bar is going up because of the seller's market. You know, if you're a strategic, you're going to have your act together to show either a commitment letter from a bank or that you have, you know, the cash on your balance sheet or a combination of both. that a seller will ask for in due diligence of your offer and your business as a qualified buyer. Likewise, if you're a financial buyer, you're going to have to be in a position to show the capacity. We've certainly seen that. And that's, by the way, commonplace in certain buyers. For example, it's commonplace in family office buyers. Family offices are always asked to show the capacity to do a deal almost universally, we've seen. And it's been that way for years and years. Because the nature, size, and scope and liquidity of family offices varies dramatically from one to the next. So, it, you know, what has happened historically with family offices is certainly becoming much more commonplace with strategic and financial buyers, as an example.
Right, absolutely. And one of the things that I think we've seen where we're cautious buyers on is that if you are pursuing an aggressive roll-up strategy, it's hard to get committed to. If you're working with a funder that requires multiple deals to close at once in order to get funding, that's really hard. And so somewhere along the line, juggling five concurrent balls at once, one is likely going to get dropped. And if that happens, you don't want it to blow up every deal. So which kind of brings me to my other point of time is, as a buyer, time is always of an essence. We really appreciate working with buyers that put an LOI out within a week of meeting someone, or a week or two. That helps just speed up the process. It's typically non-binding anyway, so it's a matter of getting someone under a lockout and getting them moved into your pipeline. So, as a buyer, really consider that analysis by paralysis on the financials and trying to make sure everything connects pre-LOI can be a death sentence to a deal, because there's other people, there's sharks circling around that same deal.
Yeah, a comment I would make on that is that, you know, we tend to run into that. You know, there's a lot of people that want to do what would be considered normative due diligence before the letter of intent, because they feel like they're making a significant commitment to a seller by issuing a letter of intent. And they are. I mean, most deals happen within high 90 percentile range of the letter of intent. They don't get retraded is a short answer, right? What you put in the letter of intent is usually how the deal comes down. It's really up to you to.
A signed letter of intent. So, I mean, there's plenty of the letter of intents that get out there that never actually get signed.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. That's a great, great point, Ryan. I'm talking about an executed signed letter of intent. And, you know, you need to understand that's what due diligence is for, is to prove your assumptions around the letter of intent, not to issue the letter of intent after you've answered all your questions about your assumptions. If you get that order wrong, you're going to lose a lot of deals. You're not going to be in the conversation, because we often say around here that speed, you know, time kills all deals, and speed is of the essence. And, you know, essentially the victor in this case are the ones that can move the fastest, and to the victor go the spoils. So it's critical that if you're going to be serious about moving on a company in a seller's market, that you quickly are able to assess and decide and execute a letter of intent on a deal that you want to do. We often hear from buyers that, yeah, we're really into moving fast. We want to get it done in, you know, a short period of time, some which is unrealistic. And whenever I hear that, I go, I kind of go, yeah, right. Because the only reason you're highlighting in this, because you're not getting them done fast, right? And typically that proves out. You know, we find people at all the time, you know, say they want to move fast and, you know, it's a 6 month, 9 month of screwing around process. It should never be that, right? It should be a situation where you're issuing letters of intent within weeks, and you're on the very outside, you're 90 days from that letter of intent to close. It should never take longer than that.
Absolutely, Mike. I agree. Covered a lot of ground here today, and the theme here is that it's got to be more than just money to get a deal done. Any parting thoughts here to our buyers that are trying to get deals done?
No, you know, I would say not really. I would say that there's still companies to be had. We still think the best companies to buy, well, I guess maybe there are a few ideas I have. The best companies to buy are ones that aren't for sale. And the best way to source companies that aren't for sale, is frankly to use an advisor. It takes a very mature and a very skilled outreach team, to engage in conversations with companies that aren't for sale and talk about the merits of your deal. And we think that, you know, that's part of why, you know, firms like Revenue Rocket have very high success rates in closing deals. And I think it's part of the reason why, you know, if you try to kind of roll your own, you know, the success rates are pretty dismal. I mean, they're around 1%. If companies try to manage this process themselves. And I think it's just because it takes a fully formed and fully baked and well-managed team, to source and, review, and have conversations, with sellers that, you know, companies that aren't for sale in a seller's market.
Great. I 100% agree. The best firms. That's why when we advise clients, we take that targeted approach. We really build everything around strategy and culture, and then make the money work at the end. Well, Mike, this has been very helpful, and I appreciate your time and insight today.
Sounds great. With that, we'll tie a ribbon on it. Appreciate everybody's time this week, late in January 2021. I wish everyone a great year, and thanks, and have a great day.